One of the focal points of my sabbatical in the United Kingdom last fall was pilgrimage. I made a point of visiting a wide variety of pilgrimage sites. Some, such as Canterbury Cathedral, have been visited by millions of pilgrims over the centuries. Others are newer pilgrimage sites, and some of them would not commonly be thought of as pilgrimage sites. In the waning days of 1170, Archbishop Thomas Becket was assassinated by King Henry II's henchmen on this spot at Canterbury Cathedral. The dispute was in truth more political than anything. Would king or archbishop have more power? But Becket went down in history as a martyred saint. Pilgrims thronged to visit the site of his assassination, his martyrdom, and also his tomb at Canterbury. And these pilgrimages inspired Chaucer's famous Canterbury Tales in 1475. 50 years after Chaucer, King Henry VIII split from the Catholic Church in another battle over political power. Henry attacked the symbols of the Catholic Church, such as Becket's beloved tomb. He had it and every sign of Becket's martyrdom removed from the cathedral. Today, a simple candle illuminates the spot where Becket's remains once lay. In spite of Henry's best efforts, though, Canterbury remains a pilgrimage site today. And here is a testament to just how many pilgrims have come to Canterbury over the centuries. There was the custom for pilgrims of climbing up these steps on their knees. It takes a lot of knees to wear down rock like that. I was awed at Canterbury by the palpable sense of history that I got there. And for me, visiting there also evoked a sense of personal history, because I had visited Canterbury when I was 11 years old or so, and was so profoundly struck by the history then. That deep sense of history is part of what the UK did, ensnaring my soul in such a deep way. And the thing that struck me about going to Canterbury this time was how the mission of that cathedral has changed into one of witnessing for human rights. Now, it would be a stretch to call Becket or Henry VIII's opponents human rights activists, but they did resist the authority of a tyrant. So the current mission today is really not disconnected from the history. It's a challenge to pull off the shift for the cathedral because in so many ways, more than anything else, it is today a museum, and it is the tourists like me who help fund the upkeep of the building. But somehow they have managed to make the mission more than being a museum. I also visited several ancient stone circles, including Stonehenge and Avebury. These sites date back some 4,500 years. Avebury is much less preserved than Stonehenge, but is 17 times larger and likely was considerably more important. Some archaeologists hypothesize that Avebury was the epicenter of a very large and elaborate sacred shrine that spanned much of the region, including Stonehenge, which is some 20 miles away. I especially loved visiting Avebury because you could walk right up to the stones, and I was also struck that the stone circle envelops part of the village. Here you see the stone houses and sheep. Tramping through the cold rain about a year ago, mostly alone, I somehow felt closer to the people who journeyed to visit and built Avebury than, say, those the dramatic assassination at Canterbury. At Canterbury, I really felt more like a tourist and an amateur historian. I still cannot fully articulate what going to Avebury meant to me. I'm still working that out, but it had a deep, deep impact on me. I also visited the Isle of Iona, a tiny, rugged island off the coast of Scotland. A According to tradition, St. Columba and 12 companions were exiled from Ireland in 563. They first settled on Iona and there established a monastery. And from there, they began the conversion of the Scots and the English to Christianity. The famous abbey, begun in the 1200s, sits on the site of Columba's monastery. The abbey has been a destination for pilgrims ever since. And like Thomas Becket's tomb, it was the target of King Henry VIII's anti-Catholicism move. The abbey was soon abandoned and fell into ruin. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, the abbey was rebuilt and morphed into this amazing, inclusive Christian center. So now people come to Iona, Christians and non-Christians, to celebrate the commonality across religious lines and to deepen their commitment to the message of peace and love and justice. One of the leaders of our campus ministry at Lawrence, in fact, a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, had the great joy of spending this last summer working, volunteering at the Iona Abbey. And she fell in love with the island and the abbey. Iona has the reputation for casting a deep spiritual spell on people. Maybe, as one Unitarian Universalist minister suggests, it's Iona's special qualities as a wild, dark, natural place, a place of contemplation, a place where one feels at home in nature's larger scheme. Maybe it's that that moves people so deeply. I actually was kind of skeptical about all that when I visited, and through some poor planning on my part, I ended up having less than 24 hours there. And yet, Iona managed to cast its spell on me as well. And while I was there, even so briefly, I did some significant internal work on my grief journey after my mom's death 3 or 4 years ago. I hope that I can return to Iona one day. A much newer pilgrimage site I visited was Liverpool, which is home to many Beatles sites. Pilgrimage sites included the childhood homes of John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Here is the flat. George's flat was in the midst of this building. I also saw George's first guitar and strawberry fields. Can't see the graffiti. There is always a field for imagination. John, we know you should be glad. People flock to Liverpool to see these sites, and in many cases, I think to get in touch with a piece of their past. I think that's what this guy was doing. And that's also what I did there. In my mind, in many ways, I wasn't so much in Liverpool as I was in my bedroom back in high school, struggling to make sense of the murder of John Lennon, or maybe finding solace after a breakup by listening to Abbey Road or Sgt. Pepper. I think my kids had a similar experience seeing some of the Harry Potter sites in studio while they visited. The Beatles and Harry Potter provided some of the myths and soundtracks of my childhood and my kids' childhood. Visiting those sites, we could not help but revisit our childhoods. And then one of the most important pilgrimage sites for me was a tiny ruined hermitage I hiked to on the Isle of Man. The Isle of Man is a quasi-independent nation between England and Ireland. And this hermitage, you can see the ruins in the middle of the picture, is not a popular pilgrimage site. I found out about it just because I got to know someone who lives on the Isle of Man and she told me about it. If memory serves, a single hermit sometime in the 800s, ventured to this spot and there built a little hut and a little chapel. And there he lived for, I suppose, as long as he could stand the solitude. It was not easy to find this place or to hike to it, and I didn't see a single person as I ventured out. Several times I thought, I'm not going to find this, and almost turned back. When I got there, There really was not a trace of humanity anywhere visible besides these ruins, which are now 1,200 years old. Just greenery, rocks, sea, and across the water, the mountains of Mourne in Northern Ireland. The only sounds were the wind, the waves pounding far below, and birds. I took a short video, which we're going to take a second to look at, to give you a sense of what this was like. At the end, I was walking toward his little house. Can you imagine living there, all alone, year after year? For me, it was easy being there to kind of imagine, a little bit at least, of what that might be like. The place seemingly had not changed. I imagined the hermit walking along the coast, arriving at this spot, and saying, "This is it. This is where I shall be." That took some imagination, some courage, some dedication, and possibly a little bit of craziness. And what I realized there is the internal spiritual need I have to find such places of solitude in my life. No, I'm not going to resettle someplace like that, even though that's kind of tempting. But I do need to carve out interior spaces in my journey that have the same sort of feeling as that little hermitage. So over the years here, I have talked about the structure of the pilgrimage experience. The anthropologist Victor Turner and before him Arnold van Gennep wrote about three stages in the pilgrimage. The first stage is separation. You leave your home, your family, your work, your place. You go someplace that is different, strange, other. Turner calls the second stage the liminal stage. This is where you experience this new, bewildering world you've stepped into. It's often depicted metaphorically as a wilderness. Because it is a foreign experience, it's wild, it's dangerous, it's full of opportunity also for growth and insight. It is in the wilds, the unfamiliar, that we actually have the opportunity to meet ourselves again with fresh eyes. That's the irony. Sometimes, like Jacob in the story Leah told, one must travel far to find what is near. And then the third stage is return or reincorporation. You go home, but because of the experience in the wilderness, you go home a different person. If a pilgrimage has moved your spirit, you return with new insights, new understandings, a new way of being in the world. And even if home is exactly as it was when you left it, it's different because you're different. You are seeing it through different eyes, experiencing it through a transformed soul. Nelson Mandela, who was no stranger to pilgrimage, put it this way: "There is nothing like returning to a place that remains unchanged to find the ways in which you yourself have altered." So returning from a pilgrimage experience is a homecoming, but it's a homecoming in the same sort of way as going to your 10th or 25th or 50th high school reunion. Yes, you're home, but wow, is it different. So in a sense, this was the structure of my sabbatical. I separated myself from my everyday world of work, family, and place. Of course, there are many connections between our culture and that of England and Scotland. I ventured truly into a foreign land. The differences struck me much more profoundly than the similarities. Now, it wasn't as different as the time I spent in Sri Lanka. I more or less shared a common language, at least with most people in England and Scotland. But It certainly was more difficult to navigate my way around literally and culturally. And more significantly for me, I had a lot of time to contemplate my life, myself, the universe, you know, the big stuff. And then I came home changed by the experience. And I'm still working out what those changes really amount to. And I think it will take years and decades to continue working through that. Now, what's most powerful to me about pilgrimage is that that structure of separation, liminality, return reflects the basic geography of our lives. And we don't need to travel to exotic places to experience that structure. I can think about this experience I've had in the Fox Valley as an example of pilgrimage, as an example of the structure. In 1990, I separated from my familiar world. I stepped into a new role, parish minister, not to mention all sorts of new experiences with family, like having kids, and the place I lived. For me, being here, this has really been a place of danger, of risk, and of great opportunity. By the time I leave next summer, I will have dwelled here for 25 years, and I will then return home. No, St. Louis, where I'm moving is not home, actually, to me. But in a powerful sense, I will be returning to myself. I will leave here and be just Roger, not Roger, the senior minister of the Fox Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Now, the experience here will have changed me, yet I will face myself again as a person with an identity of not being a parish minister. And so it'll be a homecoming of sorts to face myself again as a person without this particular identity, this identity that's been such a huge part of my life for 25 years. I will venture into a new place, a new role, a new community, and there find a piece of myself that I have not seen for a very, very long time. I expect this return to be challenging, fraught, and full of opportunity. Even as I return changed, I will be launching myself into a brand new liminal experience. This is the nature of life. Each ending is also a new beginning. As Thomas More writes, we are always home and not home, always on pilgrimage and always in various stages of homecoming. One of the challenges of being a perpetual pilgrim, which I think we all are, is figuring out how to make a home wherever we are, even in the middle of the wilderness. We are always at home and we are always in the wilds on a pilgrimage. This pilgrimage structure is also the structure of our inner journeys. When we spiritually venture into new, unfamiliar territory, we also have the opportunity to return home. That is, to return to our soul, transformed. Think, for example, about the grief journey. Grief takes us far out of what's comfortable, familiar, out of our everyday lives. It is a wild and scary and dangerous wilderness. It derails just about everyone, and some folks are never quite able to get back on the rails again. You can only get home in grief, too, by working through the wilderness. There are no shortcuts. There's no easy way home. There's no guarantee, in fact, that you're going to make it. You will learn things about yourself, and if and when you do return home, you will be a changed person. Everything will be different. Someone in the service yesterday shared about another example of this sort of internal journey, having cancer, like grief. Cancer will launch you into an unwanted pilgrimage. As Henry David Thoreau observed, this interior journey, man, these are way harder than traveling thousands of miles to an exotic place on the planet. Maybe more than anything else, pilgrimage to a sacred site or a pilgrimage within gives us the opportunity to venture into different wild territory and there to meet ourselves again for the first time. This, along with figuring out how to find a home wherever we are, this is the ultimate goal of the pilgrimage quest. In his poem Santiago, named for the terminus of the famous pilgrimage trail, El Camino de Santiago, David White writes these vivid lines. As if all along you had thought the end point might be a city with golden towers and cheering crowds. And turning the corner of what you thought was the end of the road, you found just a simple reflection and a clear revelation beneath the face looking back, and beneath it, another invitation, all in one glimpse. Like a person in a place you had sought forever, like a broad field of freedom that beckoned you beyond, like another life, and the road still stretching on.